Senate Bill 510, Dr. Bray, please.
Madam Chairman, I'm Dr. Bray, Administrator of the Mental Health Division. Here to testify on Senate Bill 510, which relates to the involuntary commitment of mentally ill persons. I'd like, to ask Dr. Cole, the Assistant Administrator for Mental Health Services, and Dr. Brooks, who chaired the task force that developed the basic ideas for this bill, to join me at the table.
Surely. Senator Smith is going to be there at that end chair. If one of you would care to sit there, and there's one chair over there.
In almost every legislative session in the last 20 years, changes have been made in Oregon's commitment laws. The result of this, I believe, is that the commitments have become more efficient and humane. Alternative methods for treatment have been developed in the communities. However, the entire commitment system has never been evaluated at one time.
Could I interrupt you? Could you give us just, you indicated that there was, you had worked together in preparing this bill. I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit about that.
Yes. What we're saying here is that because of the patchwork way in which the laws have changed, that the Mental Health Division, during the winter of 72, appointed a task force to study the commitment laws that exist now, to review the commitment laws of the other states, to look at the variety of problems that we saw in those laws, and to come up with a position that would be suitable to a number of organizations and people. Actually, 10 organizations participated in this task force and were officially requested by the division to participate, along with private practicing psychiatrists, hospital superintendents, and so forth. Attachment 1, which you find just after the main portion of this testimony, carries the membership of that task force and the persons and the organizations represented. And I believe that should answer your question about who served. Dr. Brooks from the state hospitals, Dr. Baxter, who's director of the Marion County Mental Health Clinic from the Association of Mental Health Clinic Directors, Eugene Bowie from Oregon Law Enforcement Council, John Heron from the Oregon Conference of Local Health Officers, Myron Katz from the American Civil Liberties, Judge Kay from the Mental Health Advisory Board, this is the Mental Health Division Advisory Board, and also David Kent from that board, Richard Noble from the State Bar Association, Michael Park from the Mental Health Association of Oregon, Dr. Wayne Pigeon from the Oregon District Branch of the Psychiatric Association, Judge Spencer from the Oregon Circuit Judges Association, Dr. Dan Boyce from the Oregon Medical Association, and Charles Williamson, Legal Aid. The result of this effort was, as you might presume from the membership list, a compromise on many points. But generally, one which organizations involved could accept. However, there will be some testimony following mine with specific recommendations for specific changes from the way this bill is presented. What I will present will be that compromise position which emanated from the task force. The first major area is the definition of mental illness. As you know, mental illness is not defined in Oregon statutes at the present time, and the entire bill is designed to encourage voluntary treatment within community programs in preference to hospitalization at state mental hospitals. commitment is considered to be appropriate for only for the individuals who, because of their mental illness, are dangerous to themselves or others, or they're unable to provide for their basic personal needs. Now, inclusion of this latter basic needs concept allows for the commitment of some persons, primarily in the elderly groups and chronic psychoses with organic brain syndrome, who are disoriented, out of contact with reality, unable to manage for themselves. This does not include the mentally retarded or persons who are unable to care for their basic needs, but are being properly cared for by others. And as I said before, mental illness is not defined in existing statutes. Therefore, the proposed definition is restrictive and relates to involuntary commitments only. This does not presume to define mental illness broadly for all of its other uses, but only for the purpose of commitment. Persons may legitimately seek and need voluntary admission, but not be mentally ill, but not be a mentally ill person under this definition, so that this separates that clearly. In the process of finding the definition which is contained in this law, Dr. Brooks' task force, Dr. Brooks chaired this task force, surveyed 49 states. And the second major point that the bill deals with, and gist of this testimony is to take each of the major areas of change and discuss them in general, and then we can go into specifics at your request. The second major area is commitment to the mental health division. If a person were committed under this bill, he would be committed to the mental health division rather than to a specific state mental hospital as it is in the current statute. This allows the division to arrange for treatment either at a state hospital or within the community, in a general hospital day treatment program, nursing home, or other treatment facility. This provides for not a one-response system, but a multi-response system, and with the division delegating the responsibility for the clinical decision to the communities, the decision could be made of whether or not this person would be amenable to treatment and by some other method than commitment to a state mental hospital. Procedures are defined to ensure adequate communication between the courts, community mental health programs, treating facilities, health departments, law enforcement agencies, and the division. These will be elaborated upon through administrative rules, which will allow a phase-in of alternatives to state hospitalization. I think until such alternatives are developed fully, or more developed than they are now, some counties will be continue to send all of their committed patients to a designated state mental hospital. This will not preclude that. As alternatives are developed, the county community mental health program director or his designee, based upon information in the preliminary investigation report and of the two examining persons, will determine the appropriate treating facility for the committed person, will arrange admission to that treating facility, and will follow up to assure continuity of care. Although more complex, the responsibilities are clearly defined, and treating facilities would be used in a more flexible way to meet individual patient needs than has been possible in the present system. Talking really about a basic shift in our mental health delivery of mental health service. The next major point covered in the proposed amendments to our commitment laws is the preliminary investigation and crisis treatment. Under existing statutes, commitment proceedings would be initiated by a petition, or on a petition by two persons, the county health officer or any magistrate. Under these practices, the next step varies from county to county. In some counties, a uniformed police officer visits the home and issues a citation to appear in the court at a specified time and place, or he may immediately take the person into custody and take him to a general or state hospital where the person is examined by a physician and admitted to the hospital if appropriate. The person may be detained in a jail until the hearing if the hospital refuses admission. In 6 to 10 counties, trained community mental health clinic staff or public health nurses have been visiting the person wherever he is instead of a peace officer. They work with the allegedly mentally ill person, family, and petitioners who are usually family members, neighbors, friends, or a landlord, to assess the situation, clarify it, and resolve the crisis on the spot if possible. Failing that, they try to work out a plan for voluntary treatment within the community. If they conclude that the person is probably mentally ill and in need of commitment, a report is returned to the court for further action. I hope that in some of the subsequent people who testify, you will get some firsthand experience for how this has worked in some of these counties. The investigating person who collects information, which may be helpful in aftercare planning after the person leaves the hospital, this information is collected. Peace officers may accompany the mental health staff or go instead to of the mental health staff if the person is sufficiently dangerous or uncontrollable as to require their assistance. As a result of these actions within the past year, commitments have been reduced. We've got this together on page 5 and page 4 are in the wrong order. They've been reduced by approximately 30% in these counties, even with limited alternatives to treatment being available. Statewide, there were 1,168 court commitments in fiscal year 71-72, compared with 1,559 in the prior year.
How many?
There were 1,168 court commitments during fiscal year 71-72. And in the prior years, there were 1,559.
Do you have a breakdown as to where they came from?
Yes.
Attachment 2.
And if you look at attachment 2, this is the one just following the listing of the task force members. You'll see the numbers by county by year with an average in the right-hand column. Now, these are total numbers of court commitments, and naturally, the larger counties will have larger growth numbers.
It's attachment 5, isn't it, or is it 2?
No,
it's
I'm
two.
Sorry.
So what we really have in this attachment are the counties listed and the fiscal year, and these are the court commitments only. These do not include the voluntary admissions.
Now, why is it going down, Don?
And this is because of the developments of alternatives, and also, we believe, because since we begin talking about this, and some counties are beginning to do it, beginning to screen prior to commitment, beginning to go out on the spot and see if they can solve the problem before it gets to the court, many of the commitments, if you will, are headed off the path.
Well, what could I, Madam Chairman, I just want to know what the increment in the mental health staffing has been, the community staffing has been in Multnomah and Washington counties. I mean, we'll be talking here about investigation and development of alternatives and what's been the relative increase in number of bodies available within the division to perform these kinds of services, because these figures are fairly dramatic, and I just looking at the cost implications of the staffing factor.
During the past biennium, all community mental health clinics, of which the Multnomah County Community Mental Health Clinic is one, have been held to a 5% per year growth in actual increases of bodies. So that since the 1970 beginning of this biennium, have had very little growth, very little increase in the number of people.
Well, then why the dramatic reduction if you haven't had the increase in staff? Is it because there's more facilities available for alternative types of?
Part of the reduction is the beginning of this new technique. However, we're already stretching that staff very thinly in order to accomplish this. So I think part of the answer is that the staff is increasing its its efforts manifold. Secondly, they're increasing their efforts to get involved in pre-screening to work with this segment of the population.
Madam Chairman, isn't it also true that in Portland, a lot more people are going to crisis unit now than formerly were hauled into Judge Dixon's court and shipped off to Dr. Brooks? Is that a big factor?
This is a factor. I think would fall under what we're thinking of as alternatives to hospital care. Where something else is developed, where a crisis unit, where the availability of a general hospital bed, where a day treatment center, where any of this kind of programs is developed, it's going to naturally screen off some. I'm sure the emergency room at the medical school itself shuts off some. The availability of the crisis unit takes care of some others. So
a final question, and that is, has your budget been heard in Ways and Means?
Yes.
And you're through the process, and did we hear the crisis unit budget in connection with the medical school, is it going to be rather than with mental health?
It'll be heard in connection with the medical school.
Well, personally, keep me advised, which is, if you both know my interest, and I want to work with you. Okay. Thank you.
While we're on the particular page,
I'd
like to ask the doctors, what's special about the Deschutes, Jackson, Josephine, Polk, and Umatilla counties, and I think in them, that they don't show any improvement? The improvement's dramatic in Multnomah County, but the ones I mentioned look like bad examples. I just wonder what's special about that.
Dr. Cole and Dr. Brooks, would you mind identifying yourself for purposes of the tape, please?
I'm Dr. Dean Brooks, superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital.
I'm Dr. Delbert Cole, assistant administrator for the mental health division.
They just have more mentally ill people west east of the mountains. That's a historical fact.
Well, what about Jackson Josephine? Where our friends come from?
Well, they're on the west side.
Lynn, where my neighbors come from. And Polk County, which is my district, that's where they are.
I think part of the consideration is you're looking only at court-committed patients here, and to be more complete, we should also be showing the voluntary patients that are admitted, because the ratio of court-committed to voluntary makes a difference. And if a greater proportion are coming in voluntarily, a second would be the existence of alternatives in these counties to state mental hospital care, and whereas there may be some more clear alternatives to this kind of care in other counties. Can you think of that?
Yes.
That doesn't really help me any.
One additional point on Umatilla County is that this is the county housing Eastern Oregon Hospital, so patients will come in voluntarily from other counties in Eastern Oregon and then require commitment and end up being committed within the county. So this would show up in their statistics. This is part of the reason.
And what about, you say about, same about Polk, maybe, but what about Lynn, or Josephine, or Jackson, or Deschutes? Somehow or other, you're asking.
Well, different counties have implemented early intervention techniques differently. Some have really diverted resources from other purposes to try to demonstrate that they could do things in this area. Others have not.
And the ones I mentioned have not. Is that correct?
I can't speak to on a county-by-county basis.
They stick out like a sore thumb here. I just thought they had a good reason.
There's been considerable discussion within the division over the last at least couple of years about the potential of doing this. And some counties simply on their own initiative have said, we're going to try it and see if it'll work. And this has been a local initiative, basically. Multnomah County was one of the pioneers in this area. This is not statewide at this point by any means.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you. Will you continue?
The third major point covered in this proposed changes is detention pending commitment hearings. Again, under existing statute, the peace officer responds to a petition for commitment or he otherwise identifies a person he believes to be mentally ill, and an immediate danger of himself to, or to others, he may take this person into custody and transport him to a hospital where he is examined by a physician. This is the peace officer commitment law. If the person must be transported some distance to a hospital in another county, a certificate from a licensed physician is required to ensure that he has no medical condition to preclude this. The person may be detained in a general hospital approved by the division for up to 5 days pending a hearing on a peace officer hold, or up to 72 hours when a commitment petition has been filed. At present, there is some ambiguity regarding the roles of the court, the hospital, and the treating physician. The result is confusion as to what treatment is allowable and desirable during this detention period. And again, we're moving from page 4 back forward in the document to page 5. Many individuals detained under these conditions are frightened, belligerent, confused, showing obvious symptoms of mental illness, many of which will respond to routine medical treatment, often to a sufficient degree to that no commitment or further hospitalization is necessary. The peace officer hold statutes are retained in the proposed bill, providing for immediate examination and hospitalization of a presumed mentally ill person when necessary. In addition, detention may be initiated by the person doing the initial investigation under the proposed changes. And since the person would be a peace officer when the need for detention is anticipated, they could do this immediately. The responsibility of the treating physician for emergency care, custody, and treatment during detention is clearly defined, including procedures for the use of mechanical restraints. A report of treatment and its results becomes a part of the record provided to the judge at the commitment hearing.
Dr. Bray, I wonder if I could interrupt you at this point. Your presentation is just really excellent, and we want to hear it in toto, but I wonder if at this time you could give us a summary of it, since you know these people have come from long distances. I would advise everybody that there is no one signed up against the bill, and I know these other gentlemen want your overview first, but if you could be available to us for a detailed discussion later and just give us a summary at this time so that those people who have traveled can get on and get away.
Senator Brown?
Judge Spencer?
I'm sorry. I didn't realize I should sign anything. Perhaps
yes,
I
saw you're here.
Got here too late. I am contra some aspects of this legislation.
All right. Fine. Thank you.
Let me move quickly through these other items, summarizing them. The next major point is protection of the personal rights during the commitment process. There are a number of changes in the bill proposed to clearly specify the rights of the individual during the commitment process and to protect those rights. The next is psychiatric examinations. Whereas under existing statutes, two physicians, not necessarily psychiatrists, are recommended. Under the proposed one, we could have one. This provides for more effectiveness in this evaluation process. It also allows, where there aren't adequate numbers of physicians, another mental health worker to participate, like a psychiatric nurse or a social worker or a psychologist. So it doesn't restrict it to, completely to physicians, particularly in Eastern Oregon. Some areas there are not enough physicians to accomplish this. There's the next is the limitation on duration of commitments. And Dean and Dell, as I mentioned these, if I overlook a major point, don't hesitate to interrupt me. This provides for a very clear, whereas the commitments are indeterminate at the present time. It provides for a very clear 45-day period for the commitment with rehearing procedures, and again protects the individual's rights in the commitment process, so that he has some clear, predictable time points in time when his commitment to the hospital will be reconsidered, and he'll have a right to due process. Anything on that that I've left out? Detention in jails. The present statute does allow detention of mentally ill persons in jails. We're trying to discourage that. We want to get people detained in hospitals wherever possible. We want to increase the usage of local hospitals. We believe that where there is adequate medical coverage and a secure room, this can be accomplished. Anything else on that point? Trial visit status. Under the present statutes, a person can be returned from a trial visit rather summarily by a signed statement. This would provide protection for those individuals. They would be released after 90 days from this trial visit. The Bill of Rights for Committed Patients provides for a clear statement. Now, there are patients' rights are stated in the statutes now. This expands the rights as they're stated in the statute and would provide for them being posted on the wards in the hospital, so there'd be a clear understanding of what their rights are, what they can do. A key issue in this one is the use of certain kinds of therapies, and this has been presented in other bills. And electroshock therapy is a bill in question. This bill, as written, would provide for informed consent necessary prior to the use of electroshock therapy or any other kind of potentially hazardous therapy, but would then allow for an override of that by the director of the treatment facility and an outside unrelated physician if, in their best interest, it was a life-saving measure for this person. The example given is the use of electroshock therapy for severe depression, which is often preventive of suicide. And so that would allow a procedure by which they could go beyond that. Finally, the fiscal impact of this. When, as you recognize, this was a rather large task force, worked over a long period of time, and the work was not completed at the time we drafted our Mental Health Division budget last summer. When that report did come in, I appointed a second task force, some of the people who were actually doing the job on the line, to talk about what the impact would be on them from a practical sense, and secondly, what the fiscal impact on the counties would be. I only received task force's report.
Excuse me. I watched it. There's a couple of checks.
I only received that in February. The long and short of it is, it was therefore not included in the Mental Health Division's budget for 19 for this biennial session. We are now stating there will be a fiscal impact from this. To reduce the fiscal impact statement to a brief summary, if I am able, the fiscal impact is there will be some savings on the part of the courts, on the part of the county health offices, on the part of a variety of local agencies and law enforcement. However, because of the use of mental health clinic workers in this process liberally, for instance, they will be introduced to do a preliminary hearing, and I missed that someplace in my summary, prior to find if there is cause to believe that the person is mentally ill enough to have that's the pre-screening I was talking about. It places increased demands on the community mental health clinics to such a degree that we believe it will have a significant fiscal impact on them. The solution would be either to have an increased amount of money available to the clinics. I say that because at the present time, the community mental health clinic budget contains two things. It does contain monies for alternatives to state hospital care. It doesn't contain monies for this specific function, and it does not contain growth beyond 6% per year.
Is that the budget that was just approved by Ways and Means?
Yes.
So this would be an increment to that.
That's right.
Is any consideration given to readjustment of the ratio of contribution between the local and state for the community mental health funding in view of the fact that there's going to be a savings to the localities from as far as courts and law enforcement?
Now, this information was not available to that committee because our budget was heard by...
No, the Ways and Means come out in the supplemental budget. I think that would be a selling point, Doctor. I know that both the cities and counties would, or the counties wouldn't like it.
I'll just add to that, there is an attachment, attachment 5, that summarizes our estimate of additional costs by county for implementation of this, either for the entire biennium or for the second year of the biennium.
That's the impact
on the clinic.
On the clinic. Which are funding presently, what, 50-50?
Yeah, this is total cost. So 50% of that presumably would be state cost.
So in summary, finally, we do have one proposed amendment. If the monies are not forthcoming even if they are, it's going to be difficult to make these significant changes by the 90-day period following July 1 of this year. And we would submit that an amendment to postpone, delay the enactment of this bill until July 1, 1974 would be very helpful both from the state and the county level in implementing of it, and that's included. So in summary, I think Senate Bill 510 represents the most significant change in Oregon's commitment laws probably ever. It is a result of a vast amount of work on the part of the representatives of numerous organizations who are here and who do have some specific points of difference with the bill as now drafted.
Yes, I certainly want to apologize to you for asking for your statement and summary at the present time, but I hope you will be available to us again, and we would like to hear these people out of town, so we'll notify you again.
I think, Madam Chairman, that Dr. Bray and Dr. Brooks should be commended on having anything come out of this group of people. knowing some of them as I do, and knowing the very strong feelings that they have on this, I think you all did a commendable job.
Sure, this did not represent a unanimity.
I didn't say that.
Judge Kay.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, I'm Henry Kay, Circuit Court Judge from 6th Judicial District, which is Umatilla and Morrow Counties. I was a member of the task force under the leadership of Dr. Brook, and I concur with what Senator Burns has just said with reference to the drafting of this matter. First, with reference to the question the Senator asked, why Umatilla County might be so high in the commitments that we handle in Umatilla County, about the only answer I can give you, Senator, is that because Eastern Oregon Hospital and Training Center is located in Pendleton, and it serves the greater portion of Eastern Oregon, many persons come to the state hospital in Pendleton under a voluntary commitment procedure. And then at the time that they might be seeking release from the hospital staff does not feel that they are in a condition physically or mentally to be released, and then I am called upon to do a court commitment. And so that's why Umatilla County might be higher in court commitments than some of the other counties. In the attachment, I believe, number two, it would appear that Umatilla County is about fourth statewide. And I would not want anyone to think that the residents of Umatilla County are any more mentally ill than anybody else, but we serve the larger area.
Yeah. My concern was in comparing the ratios of the 3 years, you see.
Yes.
Your county was stable, and they were bragging about a couple other counties, and then I saw some of the others you wouldn't brag about. Now, I just want to know what the variations
were. Well, we handle many commitments.
I can understand that
from Eastern Oregon.
Maybe you're doing a good job in the first place, so it's stable.
Population is increasing at Eastern Oregon Hospital.
Yes. Generally speaking, I am in favor of Senate Bill 510. I realize that where we had on our task force those who are representing the legal profession, those who are representing the medical profession, there were some of us from the judiciary. We take a different viewpoint of many of the things that are incorporated in the task force bill and in Senate Bill 510. But generally speaking, I favor most of the provisions in Senate Bill 510. There are just two or three things that I would like to call the committee's attention to. In Section 3, page 3, the law provides that the probate judge, upon being notified in writing under oath by two persons, I'm looking at lines 7 and 8, by two persons or by the county health officer or other persons. Then, if you will skip down to line 18, from there on, the sentence under Section 3 provides that every person who has been mentioned other than the two persons are exempt from criminal or civil liability, provided they have given notification acting in good faith on probable cause and without malice. I submit that the two persons who also may sign a notice of mental illness should also be exempt from criminal or civil liability, provided they have acted in good faith on probable cause and without malice. The typical example is a husband or a wife come in and feel that the other spouse is mentally ill. Children come in because of age of their parents, and they are acting in good faith and without malice and have probable cause. And I submit that they should be exempt from a criminal or civil liability, as well as the committing physician, the police officer, the magistrate, or whoever might be involved. Another point that I would...
Can I interrupt there, please?
Senator,
Judge, on this matter that you just discussed here on page 3, if the person who is being committed or is under investigation does not have the benefit of a private individual attorney, if they did, I could see your point, but I just wonder how you're going to keep these people honest.
The law, this bill specifically provides that an attorney shall be appointed for any person who is the subject of a commitment. The law specifically provides that an attorney shall be appointed. With reference to on page 8, at line 30, if in the opinion of the court the person is mentally ill, the court may order as follows. if the mentally ill person is willing and able to participate in treatment on a voluntary basis, and the court finds that he will probably do so, the court shall order the release of the individual and dismiss the case.
Line 30.
Starting at line 30, Senator, where it says that if the court finds the person is mentally ill, then at line 32, it provides that if the mentally ill person indicates that he will work on a voluntary basis, the case shall be dismissed. I submit that we have many cases where the person who has been found mentally ill will say, well, now, if you won't send me to the hospital, I'll be glad to go on an outpatient basis treatment. If it's a situation of alcoholism, I'll be glad to go to AA. I'll go to the community mental clinic. I'll do this. I'll do that. I'll do anything. Don't send me to the hospital. The present law, or the proposed law, provides that if you permit him to do this, then the petition is dismissed. But if, after he has made this representation to you that he will do all of these things, and he doesn't, then we have to go back through the whole procedure again that is set forth in detail in this bill. I submit that provision should be made for a conditional release, that if he will do these things, then he may be put on a voluntary basis.
Mm-hmm.
And the petition is not dismissed unless you want to provide it shall be dismissed after 45 days, which is the proposed time of commitment to the hospital. But I do not approve of a dismissal of the case, because then if he doesn't follow through with his representations of his voluntary treatment, then we have to start all over again. And it's rather a lengthy, detailed, and expensive
Senator
procedure.
John Burns?
Would your objection be met by substituting the word shall for may on line 34?
You may be all right. May order, then it leaves it discretionary with the judge, I believe. And he can withhold the execution of the order of commitment on condition that the individual do those things that he says he does. Have no objections to the may, leaving it discretionary. Those are the only matters that I have, Madam Chairman. I recognize that a bill such as this, with the various persons involved, I don't believe a bill is going to be drawn or be passed that's going to be acceptable to all parties concerned. But it certainly is a very decisive improvement over our present commitment laws, and I do submit that our present commitment laws do need a revision. Thank you very much.
Judge Kay. Just a minute, please. Are there any questions of Judge Kay? Thank you, Judge Kay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Judge Spencer?
I'm Douglas Spencer. I'm a circuit judge in the 2nd Judicial District, which is Lane County. I have prepared some remarks in writing, and if there's any interest, I'll leave them, 2 copies of them. I can provide more. I understood when I walked into the room that the Legal Aid Service in Portland proposes some amendments, and I don't know whether those are familiar at all to the committee or not, but I think what I'll do, if I may, Senator Brown, is proceed with the remarks that I had prepared to the bill as it now stands, and if later on there's testimony regarding some proposed amendments, perhaps the committee would let me speak briefly to those later on.
What I'm trying to do is to get you out of town people a chance to talk, so you won't have to return. Charlie, are you going to submit a
just similar to Judge Case, about four or five small amendments. We favor the bill after it's drafted.
Yeah, if you wish to speak later, you may.
You'd rather just hear me entirely later? Or shall I go ahead with what I have now?
Why don't you go ahead?
All right. My first remarks are directed to the probable cause investigation provided prior to the issuance of a citation and after the filing of a petition. Probable cause, as that term is understood by judges in connection with the issuance of arrest warrants and search warrants, is a determination the judge is to make on the basis of sworn statements. If the sworn statements include not only matters within the personal knowledge of the affiant, but also hearsay statements of third persons, the affidavit must state why the affiant places reliance upon the hearsay statements of the third party. By analogy, if the proposed legislation really contemplates that the judge shall make a determination of probable cause based even in part on the investigation report, it would appear that due process requires that the report be sworn to by the investigator and that the investigator state specifically and in detail what each third person told him and state specifically whether or not he, the investigator, places credence in what each third person told him and why he does or does not place credence in it. When the report has been completed, it shall be promptly submitted to the court.
What pages are you on, Judge?
At this point, I am on section 3, subsection 3. If the court following the investigation concludes that there is probable cause.
Thank you.
The court is then to determine whether or not there is probable cause to believe that the judge investigated, that the person investigated, is a mentally ill person. Obviously, the judge is to read the report. That's in section 3, subsection 3. But the investigative report is not to be introduced in evidence at the hearing without the express consent of the alleged mentally ill person. That's in section 9. Does this mean that the judge who read the report for the purpose of finding probable cause is disqualified to conduct the hearing because he possesses this forbidden information? If so, the problems this procedure would create in single judge districts is obvious. And note that the doctors have seen the investigator's report to assist them in their evaluation of the subject. That's in subsection 3, or section 3, subsection 4. These doctors make their reports in writing to the court. That's in section 11. These findings presumably would be based in part on the investigative report which they have read. The judge, who has not seen the investigative report, must then evaluate the doctor's reports, which are based in part upon the investigative report. Then, too, under Section 9, the alleged and mentally ill person has the right to cross-examine the doctors. He can hardly do a complete job of cross-examining the doctors without inquiring into the weight they gave to various aspects of the investigative report, and therefore they may be forced to consent to its being received into evidence. My objections to this probable cause investigation go beyond the problems involved in its administration. I consider it poor policy for the following reasons. First, I believe the investigation to be unnecessary. In the meetings of the task force which drafted this proposed legislation, it was never suggested that there is, in fact, a problem to which this investigatory procedure is the solution. I was a member of that task force. I know of no data that would indicate that mental hearings are being held without probable cause. The sworn statements of the two citizens or of the county health officer or magistrate, together with some sophisticated questioning of the petitioners by court personnel, seem to be ensuring that probable cause exists before a warrant is issued, to the best of my belief, on the basis of personal experience and on the basis of what I could learn in serving on the task force. Second, the procedure is time-consuming. It is not unreasonable to suggest that several days could elapse before the investigation would be completed and the written report considered by the judge. There are many times when a decent regard for the welfare of people requires moving faster than that. The subject may need prompt medication or hospitalization. There is a real risk that during the delay, uncertainty and fear will cause anxiety in the subject. By the time the investigator could get well started under the present procedure, that is, under the proposed procedure, we could have brought the subject in, held a hearing, and had the subject either back home or in the hospital. Third, the investigation is an outrageous invasion of privacy. By the time we have interviewed relatives and neighbors, it really won't make any difference whether there is probable cause or not. Everyone will know that the person is being checked out to see if he is mentally ill. On the other hand, under present procedures, we can pick a person up in the morning and have him home by noon if he is not to be committed. And unless he or the petitioners talk about it, there's no reason for anyone to know. Now, with regard to the appointment of counsel, I've indicated in my remarks here that the statute does, there's a gap in the statute, I think, as it presently exists and as it's continued, and that is that, as it's proposed, unless counsel is waived, we may now appoint, and we must appoint under this new statute, an attorney. And I simply point out to you that unless it's waived, this would require us to appoint an attorney, whether the individual was able to afford one or not. If he is able to afford an attorney and does not choose to do so, under the statute, we'd still have to appoint one because he hasn't waived one. Now, that's a distinction without a difference in Lane County, because we don't think a person can waive an attorney if he's committed. And so the way we view it is a waiver of attorney is all right if we don't end up committing him, but if we do, it's not. So we appoint a committee, an attorney in every case where he doesn't have one.
Who pays him?
The county pays them poorly.
Court? How? I mean,
with the budget that we get from our county commissioner to do that.
There's no statutory procedure for it now, is there? I mean, you don't come under 135 on criminal appointments.
No.
So you just, by agreement between the court and the county commissioners, you pungled up some money to pay.
I guess that's true, Senator Burns. It was done that way when I went on the bench, and I've never questioned it.
I think it's done the same way in the juvenile court.
I assume
that's true. But I simply point out that if you do think that there is such a thing as a waiver, then I would point out that in the way this is worded, in 6, this is section 6, subsection 2, and it's on page 6 of the bill. If the person, it's subsection 3, I'm sorry. If the person is unable to afford counsel, the court shall provide by order for,
If no request for legal counsel is made,
the court shall appoint counsel unless counsel is expressly, knowingly, and intelligently refused by the person. And as I say, we don't think that they can expressly, knowingly, and intelligently refuse it, but if they could, we still think that if they don't, we must appoint counsel, and we know of no basis for doing that except at public expense, even though, as I say in my remarks, it may be J. Paul Getty who is the alleged mentally ill person. With regard to the limitation on the period of the initial commitment, and this is contained in section 12C, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19. The limitation to commitment for 45 days contained in subsection 12.3 and the provision of section 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19 address themselves to no problem that I know of. I have heard no one suggest that patients in our state hospitals are being kept longer than necessary. These provisions proceed on the assumption that the administrations of our mental hospitals cannot be relied upon to discharge their patients when they no longer need hospitalization unless judges require them to do so. I have no reason to believe this is so. Even if it ever should be, I believe the writ of habeas corpus provides an adequate remedy. These sections will obviously cost the state and counties considerable in terms of the time of judges, physicians, lawyers, and court and hospital personnel. I would prefer to see the valuable time of such persons employed to solve real problems. And then I raise the question, what is the cost of hearings that is to be charged back to the county of residence? The statute says that the cost of hearings, because it would put such a burden on the counties in which the hospitals are located, on the courts in those counties, that the cost of hearings is to be charged back to the county of residence. And I raise the question, how do you compute the costs of hearings? Do such costs include the time of the court reporter, court clerk, and bailiff? Do they include a sum which amortizes the cost to the county of maintaining the judge's courtroom, chambers, and library? I don't have any figures to support it, but I suggest that this might require another judge from Marion County. It may not amount to that much, but it could very easily. And although it's flattering to judges to have it suggested that judges are the only people in our society that can be ultimately trusted, I don't have any reason to believe that that's true. And it seems to me that if the administrations of our hospitals are keeping people beyond the necessary limit, maybe we ought to look to the administration of our hospital rather than setting up additional procedures to have judges passed on a question like this, which is basically outside their area of expertise in any event. I strongly support section 22, which establishes the criteria for discharge to be the converse of the criteria for commitment. Prohibition against confinement in jail, I would only point out that there are times when the jail is the only facility in the community secure enough to hold a violent, mentally ill person. We have a facility in Lane County, better than all but a very few counties in the state, at Sacred Heart Hospital for holding mentally ill persons. And they're beginning to complain that our patients tear the place up and disrupt their procedures, their proceedings, and orderly conduct of their hospital. And yet this bill would say that we may not, under any circumstances, put these people in jail, and that would apply equally to counties that have no hospitals. And I would agree that it's desirable that they be placed in hospitals. But I don't think you have to say that a judge cannot. There are instances when mentally ill patients have to be forcibly and severely restrained to be prevented from pulling the plumbing right off the wall. And they don't want, we have a hospital, but they don't want that kind of.
Thank you, Judge Spencer. Questions on Judge Spencer?
Do you have any private psychiatric security facilities in Wayne County, like Sacred Heart? Do they have a psychiatric security unit? Well, you know, I think we have one at Old St. Vincent, and I don't know whether we do at New St. Vincent, but in the private sector, outside the state, we have psychiatric facilities which have some security in them.
Yes. The Robert O. Johnson unit at the Sacred Heart Hospital does have some security facilities.
Where I could where you, at your own expense, you can.
And they do use this, and it works out all right in 98% of the cases. Occasionally, they'll call us up and say, they've pulled everything off the wall, and can you get them out of here? And that's the situation that Lane County might be faced with. And then I'm also concerned about the counties that just don't have hospitals.
Judge Kaye, did you wish to make comment?
If I may interrupt just a moment, I don't mean to appear to be in disagreement with my colleague, but I would submit to the committee that subsection 5 of section 3 would cover the situation that Judge Spencer is concerned about of problems.
What page?
On page 4 at line 18, subsection 5 of section 3. That subsection covers the situation that concerns Judge Spencer of time delay in an investigation. The subsection provides that if the court finds there is probable cause to believe that failure to take the alleged mentally ill person into custody pending the investigation or the hearing, then a warrant may issue and the patient may be taken into custody under an emergency situation. And I submit probable cause can be given by the person who's making the complaint of the mental illness of the individual. And I believe that Judge Spencer is unduly concerned about this delay in investigation. And I believe that that subsection would cover his problem.
Thank you, Judge Kaye. Are there other questions of Judge Spencer?
May I just say briefly, and I don't mean to argue with Judge Kaye. This says when the court finds that there'd be an imminent and serious danger to the person or to others, and I'm thinking of the unhappiness and anxiety caused by the delay, not so much a danger to either the patient or the community.
Thank you very much, Judge Spencer. Mr. David Corley, okay. Would you sit up there, or is that not convenient? Why don't you go ahead and sit where you are? Mr. David Coffey, who wishes to testify on the bill.
Well, my paper is not exhaustive. I would like to treat it more at length later. However, I have appended a few notes since the beginning of the meeting, which I will try to include. Perhaps I won't be able to do my very best, but I will try. I'm an ex-mental patient. My problem is epilepsy, not psychosis. I have an atypical form that perhaps not one person in 100,000 or perhaps a million would display the same symptoms. The symptoms do parallel some forms of what is subsumed under mental or under mental illness. For example, I was called a schizophrenic, paranoid type. This is a temporary draft, an improved draft will be made later. The greater the difference in relative strength between two factions, the greater is the tendency of the stronger of the two to trespass against, exploit, and despise the weaker. Paradoxically, paradoxically, in significant ways, the mental health establishment, parentheses, not subsumed for practical and obvious reasons, are the, quote, mentally ill, unquote, and excluded, is reference to the, quote, incompetent, unquote, perpetrates the deception that it and the, quote, mentally ill, unquote, are indeed factionated. The way to attenuate, parentheses, but not eliminate, parentheses, closed, the bad characteristics of the factionalization is to increase the relative strength between the, quote, mental health, unquote, establishment and the, quote, mentally ill, unquote, to the point that the, quote, mentally ill, unquote, demand respect from the, quote, mental health, unquote, establishment. The term mental illness is a misnomer. But first I should say, I appended this after listening here. The term mental illness can't be defined medically because it doesn't exist in a medical context. The term mental illness, if anything, is in the police sphere. CSAWS. The term mental illness is a chimera, an intellectual aberration, a mare's nest, an ignis fatuus, a foolish lie. The term is punitive, pejorative, denigrating, and exploitive. But for all that, it is probably not best at present to hassle over it too much. I urge that in SB 510, the amended portion, at least, of ORS 426.290, section 27, appearing in line 12-20 on page 16 of SB 510, be stricken. Quote, unless they have given their express and informed consent, this right may be denied to such persons for good cause only, by the director of the facility in which the person is confined or is designee, but only after consultation with an approval of an independent examining physician. Any denial shall be entered into the patient's treatment record and shall include the reasons for the denial. Parentheses or quotation marks closed. SB 510 is only an act of retrenchment. As it stands, it should not be passed. More hearings on it should be held. And I want to emphasize the as it stands portion. I think it is a great improvement over the law already established concerning what are known as the mentally ill and incompetent, and you know, in this area. But I think more hearings on it should be held. And since I was listening, I have another important thing to say. No one should be committed on the basis of being considered dangerous to himself or others, except on the basis of incompetency. If he has indeed committed a crime, then he should be treated in the criminal arena. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coffey. The gentleman from Douglas County, is it Dr. Waterman?
Yes. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dr. John H. Waterman, and I'm a psychiatrist, and for 18 years I was director of the mental health section of the Oregon State Board of Health and the community services section of the mental health division.
Very valuable man. I'm glad to see you again. You helped Ben County out a lot.
I've been here a long time. As a matter of fact, I'm retired. That's why I'm down in Douglas County now. Multnomah County kicked me out when I got to be 65. I came here not particularly to represent the group because I wasn't in on the all of the planning except more or less as a consultant with my colleagues. And I came also because I just wanted to say that even under our old law, I've probably served on as many commitment hearings as any psychiatrist that I know of. And I have never seen anyone actually railroaded into the hospital. Now, this does not, however, mean that this law is not a good one. I think it's an excellent law, the new one, the new bill. I think it has some of the objections that have been raised by both Judge Spencer and Judge Kaye that need to be evaluated and thought about. And also in relation to the investigation, I think investigations are necessary for us as physicians to render good diagnoses in relation to patients. And for this, I am glad to see as many good investigations as can be made so that we can have good information to help us make a really justifiable diagnosis. The legality part of it that Dr. Judge Spencer brought up and Judge Kaye brought up, I would leave to them. But I would just say that we should have available to us as physicians as much information as we can get about the patient in order to make a good diagnosis to whether he belongs in the hospital or not. I'm also in favor of the whole trend of the bill, which is to provide community services for mentally ill persons, and we have accomplished that in Douglas County recently, where we have a holding facility, just as Sacred Heart does, where we have two maximum security rooms where we can hold dangerous patients, and we also have a psychiatric ward where we can treat patients, and also where we can hold alcoholics for detoxification. Now, I think these things can be developed, and I think they have to be developed, and as Dr. Bray mentioned, not every community has all these facilities, and if they don't have them, then it's important that we encourage that they get them. I just want to say that in general, I'm in favor of the bill, and I'm in favor that it should be, however, financed properly, as Dr. Bray pointed out. But I don't think the clinics, per se, could undertake this kind of thing. I know our clinic couldn't in Roseburg.
Thank you, Dr. Waterman. Other questions of Dr. Waterman? Thank you, Doctor. I can't tell from reading the sheet. Mr. Hicks, are you from Eugene?
Yes.
Would you come up, please?
Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Jeffrey Hicks, and I'm representing the Board of Social Issues of the Oregon Psychological Association. We of the board are strongly in favor of the passing of Senate Bill 510. There are a couple of areas of the bill over which we experience some concern, and I'd like to go over those briefly.
And you're a psychologist.
Yes. I would refer you to page 4, lines 21 and 22. Actually, I should start somewhat before that. If the court finds that there is probable cause to believe that failure to take the allegedly mentally ill person into custody pending the investigation or hearing would pose an imminent and serious danger to the person or to others, the judge may issue a warrant of detention to the community mental health program director. Our concern came from feeling that this might place the community mental health director in the position of jailer, and we react to that fairly strongly.
credibility, huh?
Yes, I think the issue of credibility is of paramount importance in that section.
What would you substitute for it?
Well, it seems we talked this over, and our consensus was that the detention proceeding should be relegated to existing law enforcement agencies for actual detention. The second, are there questions about?
Senator Hoyt. We all hear about the cases where a person in ordinary civilian clothes would approach a patient, and they could discuss this on somewhat of a normal basis. But a man in a white coat comes, or then the guy wants to start climbing the wall, just like you and I would. I just wonder if you agree on that, then. How are you going to do this and do it right, as long as you don't have to have somebody there to put in the straitjacket?
Well, my concern was more with the community mental health director and his designee not being in a position of taking the person into custody. If an existing law enforcement agency were to perform this function, then I would hope that it would be done with a great deal of discretion.
But
so
how are you... how can you be sure that there's going to be discretion when you don't have a person who's trained in this particular skill of talking to a person who's disturbed?
Great. And that is an issue. I'm not sure that I have a solution to that.
Should there be two of them? The husky guy and the doctor?
I don't think it's necessary that you have uniformed people breaking down the door. On the other hand, I don't see why it wouldn't be feasible to have ununiformed law enforcement personnel.
Well, Madam Chairman, I'm sympathetic with the suggestion of his amendment, but it seems like he's not offering a solution that really meets the situation as he envisions it himself. I think I'd like to see a more elaborate amendment if that's what you have in mind.
Well, Madam Chairman.
Senator Burns, may I ask Judge McLennan, who executes warrants in Multnomah County now? When you issue a warrant,
Multnomah County Department of Public Health.
And if they need help, do they get a uniformed deputy or?
Yes, on some rare occasions they do get a uniformed police officer to accompany them. Now we have three men, all of whom have, and one woman, all of whom have training in police work, so that they're usually able to handle any situation by themselves.
Right, so what the witness was saying, I think, is that present system is preferable to the closed system in the sense that it takes the mental health program director out of the catchment process.
That's exactly right.
Well, Charlie, we'll get to you later unless you've got something right on that.
I just wanted to point out to the committee that the same language that's added where he's referred to is already in the existing statute. It's simply deleted on the previous page, lines 12 and 15 on page 3.
Thank you.
So it's already existing law.
Will you continue, Mr. Hicks, or Dr. Hicks?
The second area of concern that the board expressed referred, I'll refer you to page 16, line 12 through 20. Mentally ill persons committed to the division shall have the right to be free from potentially unusual or hazardous treatment procedures, including lobotomy and electroshock therapy, unless they have given their express and informed consent. This right may be denied to such persons for a good cause only by the director of the facility in which the person is confined or his designee, but only after consultation with and approval of an independent examining physician. Any denial shall be entered into the patient's treatment record and shall include the reasons for the denial. Our concern was that when a person who is not mentally ill is hospitalized and there is a procedure suggested, such as any form of surgery, it's usually a procedure to consult that person's relatives, and I don't see anything in here about that. it leaves it up to the director of the facility. And I see nothing that would include next of kin, person's spouse. And I don't understand why that is the way it is, but I would suggest that, that be included.
Questions of Dr. Hicks? Are there further things, Dr. Hicks?
Just a brief summary.
Not right now. Go ahead.
In the Senate Bill 510 provides extensive alternatives to court commitment to a state hospital for mentally ill persons and provides protection of the civil rights of court-committed mentally ill persons. And allows for examination by persons other than physicians, for example, psychologists, provides for examination in an environmental setting familiar to the person being examined, which I feel is of the utmost importance, and has earlier been pointed out, the results of that examination shall be provided to the person examined, a copy of that actual examination, and that this bill specifies a commitment period of a maximum of 45 days. The Board of Social Issues strongly, or feels that this bill is a very powerful piece of legislation and is strongly in support of its passage.
Thank you. Questions of Dr. Hicks? Thank you, Dr. Hicks. Judge McGlendon, did you wish to testify?
Yes, please. Sorry.
All right.
I signed in, but they don't. Obviously, you can't read my speech.
Maybe that's it.
In any event, I'm William S. McClennan. I'm a circuit court judge from Multnomah County. I am in Department Number 7, which is assigned probate jurisdiction, and hears all of the mental commitment hearings that are conducted in Multnomah County. In any one year, there are approximately 3,000 referrals made to the court in Multnomah County. Of these, as many as 800 result in commitment hearings. I have a staff of three persons who are devoted to this, and I spend about half of my time conducting these hearings. As has been mentioned, in Multnomah County, over the last several months, we have had public health nurses who have been employing pre-commitment screening process on an experimental basis, and as far as I can determine, this appears to be quite satisfactory. It has reduced substantially the number of hearings that have come before the court. The Senate Bill 510 contains a number of provisions which relate to due process in the court hearing, I have been employing, and Judge Dixon before me accorded to the prospective patient or the alleged mentally ill person substantially all of those due process rights which are proposed to be put into the statute by Senate Bill 510, but particularly with respect to the question of notice. We are very fortunate in Multnomah County to have the facilities of the crisis unit at Multnomah Hospital, which is maintained by the University of Oregon Medical School. In those cases where the alleged mentally ill person has not had ample notice, quite often I do order that that person be returned to the crisis unit for a period of time before the hearing in order that that person might prepare for the hearing, and in order that we might get some evaluation from the crisis unit as to how the person behaves in the hospital. Likewise, with respect to the right of counsel, as Judge Spencer stated the practice to be in
Lane County to practice in Multnomah County is that the alleged mentally ill person has counsel in every case. They are offered an opportunity and time within which to employ their own attorney. They're offered an opportunity if they do not have funds to select their own attorney, at which point I will appoint that attorney for them, and that fee will be paid by the county. Or finally, if they do not have any particular attorney in mind, or if they do not select an attorney, I will appoint the public defender. A high proportion of the cases are handled by the public defender. The public defender has an attorney in my court every morning, 5 days a week. He has become extremely expert in handling this kind of case and representing his client's rights most vigorously. And I found that this has been a very satisfactory arrangement.
Judge, I don't believe the people in back can hear you.
All right, I'll try to talk up a little more and into the microphone. The prospective patient is offered the opportunity for a public trial, or if they prefer, the opportunity that the matter be heard in chambers. In probably 99%, the person elects to have the matter heard in chambers, in which time the public is excluded and not available. The transcript of the hearing is made in every case. The we also have a very beneficial thing in Multnomah County, and that the public defender, in order, in addition to providing us with an attorney every day, also provides us with a social worker who can make provisions for alternatives to commitment, and is also very valuable in terms of follow-up in cases where people have been committed. She can go home and close their apartment and pick up their necessary clothing and make provision for feeding the cat and the dog and that sort of thing, which is often, quite often necessary. I would like to mention one other aspect of Senate Bill 510, and that has to do with the right of a patient to be in the mental hospital, to be free from the performance of lobotomies and electroshock therapy. I've had a number of cases where persons had previously been in the state mental hospital and had been subjected to electroshock therapy, and they look at me and they say, "Judge, I've been there. I know what it's about. I don't want any more electroshock therapy. Please do anything. I'll go voluntarily. I'll do anything, but I don't want to go back." On the basis of being a court-committed patient, because if I do, then I will be subjected to, or possibly be subjected to, electroshock therapy. When I talk to Dr. Geis at Famish, he tells me that very, very rarely do they ever use the electroshock therapy, and psychosurgery is practically completely obsolete. Since they don't do it anyway, it would be so much easier on the system if I could look at these people with a straight face and say, "Look, are you not going to have to submit to electroshock therapy or lobotomy without your express informed consent, and so don't worry about it."
Thank you, Judge McLennan. Are there questions of Judge McLennan? Ms. Underhoy?
Judge, do you see any contradiction, as was suggested earlier this afternoon, between the matter of the reports and then the judge, and they're not being used in the hearing? Is that a matter that bothers you as you read the bill?
No, I do not find that. I understood Judge Spencer's comments and on that, but I really don't think that is going to be a major problem. we do have reports from our pre-commitment screening team come in now. Unless there is objection from counsel, I do make those available to the panel of physicians. So far, I know of no case where the attorney has objected to the examination of that by the panel of physicians.
Madam Chairman.
Senator White.
I'm just wondering if it would be possible for these two judges to get together in chambers, so to speak. At least at a private bar, and discuss this and come up with some, because the reason, Madam Chairman, is that this is apparently a very significant piece of legislation. We want to have it right, and if this is a matter that you've accommodated yourself to, but the language is wrong, if Judge Spencer is correct.
Well, I think Judge Spencer has given us his remarks in writing, and if Judge McClendon finds time to do so, that'll be fine, but I'm sure we want all the help we can get on this, but I think they've worked in committee, and it will be our determination. Are there further questions? Thank you, Judge McClendon.
Thank you very much.
We have three more bills to hear and 20 minutes to hear them in. From glancing over the list, I'm assuming that all of you can be available. There will be another hearing on this bill. It's my assumption that you could all be available. Is there anyone that this is not true of?
Pardon, I have an important question to ask of the judge. Who
no, I'm sorry. We don't allow questions of the witnesses. Yes, sir?
Madam Chairman, I'm Dr. Wesson, the Clinic Director of the Association. I would not be available tomorrow.
Where are you from?
From Portland.
All right, sir. Come forward, please.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Don Weston, President of the Oregon Association of Mental Health Clinic Directors. This is the group of men who conduct the mental health programs in the community clinics of the state. Our programs are varied because of the varied geography of our state and the variety of emotional needs of the people of Oregon. I'm also the director of the Tualatin Valley Guidance Clinic, the mental health facility for Washington County. I'm a clinical psychologist with 18 years of experience in treatment, diagnosis of emotional problems with children, adolescents, adults, and families. Our Clinic Directors Association devoted a good deal of discussion to this bill because we feel it is a very important piece of legislation. The concept of commitment of people to the mental health division rather than commitment to a particular hospital is an excellent aspect of Senate Bill 510. This permits much more flexibility in planning for appropriate treatment approaches. At the present time, the courts have only the state hospitals as a treatment facility to which they can commit people. While this bill would ensure that people could have the necessary services, the necessary care at other alternative facilities.
Dr. Weston, I would ask that you would summarize your testimony, if you would, please.
All right, thank you. We feel that the commitment of people to the division would be helpful in providing more appropriate care. The pre-commitment evaluation aspect of this is also excellent. This gives an opportunity for a mental health person to look at the situation and to see if there are not other ways of handling the problem than having the person go to the state hospital. We've testified before other committees that we feel this legislation is closely related to the alternatives legislation because the purpose of the pre-commitment screening, as we see it, is to find other ways of responding to the individual's problems than hospitalization. Another aspect of this bill that we would like to respond to is the use of one mental health professional and a physician rather than two physicians for commitment procedure. In many of the counties of the state where there are few physicians or the physicians who are available are not experienced or particularly interested in mental health issues, this presents a real problem for the medical community. We feel that it is helpful to have mental health personnel participate in the commitment procedure as this bill allows. We support the passage of Senate Bill 510 because it is a forward step in providing appropriate care which is responsive to people's needs. But we are concerned that this bill might be passed without funding. As it is written, the judges could order the community clinics to do pre-commitment evaluations. In some counties with very small number of commitments, this could be absorbed without additional staff. In other counties, this would mean that either other aspects of the community mental health program would have to be shut down or not performed in order to have people to do this. So that we feel that if funds are available to support this, it's an excellent piece of legislation. We would point out also that there are costs to the counties in some of the procedures of this bill, but we hope that the legislature will see the importance of this, be able to provide funds, that the counties will also meet their part in this.
Thank you, Dr. West. We'll turn to Senate Bill 255. Yes, sir?
I also would have an inconvenience imposed upon me. You have to come down again.
Well, where are you from?
Portland, Oregon.
Yes, well, I am putting off at least five other Portland people. I apologize to all of you who, if you are interested, will have...
I made a special trip and signed up first. If I'm not mistaken, my name is the first on the list because I wanted very specifically to get this opportunity to testify. I won't be able to come down again.
Well, if you will submit your testimony in writing, we'll take it. We have to get to our other bills. Senate Bill 255, Judge
Swan. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, by reason of your shortage of time, I will limit my remarks to a very brief mention that the board vigorously supports this bill. It is one that, fortunately, does not affect many people, but when it does affect people, it can have very difficult effects. It grows out of court decisions which have provided that unless a injured workman's compensation rights have been determined by the board prior to the event of his death, for unrelated causes, by court decision, his family is not entitled to receive the benefits that this workman would have received had he lived. The purpose of the bill is to correct that inequity and enable the family to retain the rights that the injured workman would have had he lived. Now, this applies only in the event of a permanent partial disability, not where there may have been a total disability prior to death. And where the death occurs, as I didn't state very well, where the death occurs prior to the time the determination has been made as to the extent of this permanent partial disability. The effect of this bill is to permit this determination to proceed just the same as though this man had lived. This is a second reference on this bill. It has been cleared by the Labor Committee. Now goes to this committee. I do not know the procedure of this committee. I know Senator Keith Burns is very familiar with the purpose and intent of this bill and heard the discussion of it in the Labor Committee, and perhaps he could inform you otherwise. I don't want to take more of your time other than we vigorously support this bill and the purposes it's intended to fulfill.
Other questions of Judge Sloan? Senator White.
If a permanent disability had been determined, what would be the status of his estate?
Then his family gets it.
Well, it's vested it, then, is it?
This is the problem. It's just the sheer happenstance that maybe this would have been sent in. The board maybe not have acted on it. It may have been a variety of causes that this could have occurred. But it is just a happenstance type of thing that the family can get caught in this predicament, and we feel that it is, I say it isn't something that happens very often, but when it does happen, it is something that can be very tragic.
Questions? Thank you, Judge Swan. Ev?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ev Maligon. I'm an attorney from Eugene. I'm representing the American Trial Lawyers Association and the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys today, and the only thing that I would add to what Judge Sloan has said is to read briefly from the opinion of the Supreme Court that caused this problem. And that was Burdick versus Compensation Department, 254, Oregon, 136. Now, I'll just read Justice O'Connell's dissent as follows. According to the majority opinion, if a workman loses both hands, thus suffering permanent total disability, and dies before an award is made, his widow is entitled to benefits under the Workman's Compensation Act. But if a workman loses one hand, thus suffering permanent partial disability, and dies before the award is made, his widow gets nothing. There would appear to be no reason for the legislature to make a distinction between these two types of cases. The majority opinion does not offer any reason other than the difference in the wording of ORS 656.208 and ORS 656.218. It is reasoned that since ORS 656.218 expressly refers to a workman, quote, receiving monthly payments, end quote, and provides for the continuance of such payments, this necessarily presupposes that an award has already been made. In the usual case, the award will have been made before the workman's death, and he will therefore be receiving monthly payments. Since this is so, it's very likely that the draftsman of the section was simply reciting the normal case when the section would be operative. I do not regard the language as an expression of a legislative intent to exclude cases in which the workman was not receiving payments before his death. ORS 656.218 can be interpreted as if to read, in case of the death of a workman entitled to receive monthly payments, etc. I would so interpret the statute and affirm the trial court.
What page are you reading in?
Pardon me, Senator, I... It's 142.
Thank you.
Now that's the situation as it exists in Oregon, and it's a highly inequitable situation of the family of the workman. As that happens, though, the workman can die of unrelated causes to his accident one day before the permanent partial disability award is made, and the family will receive nothing.
Question.
Chairman, you mentioned 656.208 also. Only the one part needs to be amended, in your view.
Yes, only one part. 208 refers to permanent total disability.
That's good.
Good question. Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you.
Lloyd, Mr. Frederick.
I'm Carl Frederick, member of the staff of Associated Oregon Industries, and I'd like to speak very briefly in opposition to this bill. As the previous witnesses indicated, under the current law, if there's been a determination made and the claimant is receiving permanent partial disability, actual payments, and dies during the period from causes unrelated to the accident, for example, if he dies in an automobile accident or something like that, the payments will be made to the persons who would have been entitled to receive death benefits. And if there are no such persons, then there's the burial allowance allowed. The second situation I mentioned is if a person dies from unrelated causes during a period he was receiving permanent total disability, then of course the payments would be made. But both situations I described are cases where there have been actual determinations been made and the extent of the disability is known, or at least has been determined. We feel that theoretically the bill could have, could keep a claim open for a considerable period of time. I would think that there would be some real administrative problems, contrary to what Judge Sloan may have said. I think it would be very difficult and highly speculative in some situations to make a determination when the person isn't around. I think as a practical matter, the degree of disability for a claimant who no longer exists be examined, for example, and this is a procedure they use under closed-end evaluation in many situations. They'll bring the individual in, look at him physically, and determine the extent of disability. It would be really a subjective exercise in those cases, and it would be be extremely difficult to come up with a fair evaluation for all parties concerned. Now, again, I'm not saying there are a great number of cases involved here, and Senator Burns, I don't think the cost would be prohibitive or anything like that. But when you did get a case like this, I think it would be an extremely difficult case to resolve for all parties concerned, and therefore we would speak in opposition to it.
Senator
Hart. What did you say? Is the possibility to be as much injustice on one side as the other?
I think there would be. I think there would be. Because the man is not there physically.
Well, he might be entitled to it.
Could be. But on the other hand, you don't just know exactly what the extent of disability is.
Senator Keith Burns.
Are you talking about compensability or the evaluation?
Well, evaluation, and if I understand this bill correctly, Senator, it speaks to compensability. It goes beyond determining extent of permanent partial disability. I think Section 3 and 4 permits the claim to be extended on and on and on in certain situations.
Well, I'm talking about compensability. I'm talking about the liability. Are you talking about that, too? What is the person?
No, I was just talking about the pure determination of the extent of disability, Senator.
That's the only problem.
Yeah, that would be the problem.
Did the Supreme Court reverse the Court of Appeals, or did it?
No, this was prior to the Court of Appeals. They reversed the circuit court judge from Coos County to let award it benefits.
Okay, thank you. Further questions, Mr. Frederick? Thank you, Mr. Frederick. Is there anybody else that wanted to be heard on 255? Then we'll turn to House Bill 2100. Is that the same book, Harriet, or the other one?
The other book.
The other book. Mr. Ward.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Harvey Ward, representing the Motor Vehicle Department.
2100.
We provide a service now to accept summons and complaints on non-residents. This bill would allow lawyers to serve the division on all residents they could not locate in the state. We anticipate that quite a few in terms of numbers and a cost of about $2,000. But since the bill authorizes a $2 fee to be associated with the and accompany the summons, the revenue to the highway fund would be about $2,500. Net effect of the increase of $500 to the highway fund.
This is essentially a long arm statute, then?
I beg your pardon?
This is essentially a long arm statute, then?
It does away with the necessity to put in a showing of due diligence in your affidavit in order to get non-resident service. Is that
where,
right?
Where is that?
Am I wrong on that?
I think so. We are, near as I can tell, a motor vehicle is just a custodian of these things where people can come. We have about 450 a year right now. We are asked to look into that file about 6 times during the year on behalf of lawyers. But, we are just a clerical function. We're neither for or against this bill. It just expands what we do now.
Where on the bill is it that you delete the due diligence?
We delete it on line 4, page 3. But Madam Chairman, this is a bar bill. And this committee hasn't been accorded the dignity of an appearance by a member of the committee of the bar that asked the legislature to put this in. And maybe there was a good and legitimate reason for it, but I've been on the bar's back for 8 years now to become more functional as a lobbyist. And I'd like to write a blistering letter to them to find out why we don't have somebody from the bar committee down here to answer that question.
Are you instructing me to do so?
Oh, I guess I'm just talking at the end of a long hearing that you handled very well.
Okay, we'll have Mr. DeWitt investigate why they weren't
you say your department takes no stand on this bill?
No. You know,
does it help you or hurt you?
It's a nuisance, but we do it, and it takes about a quarter of a girl.
Does it change your job then?
No, it just...
What good is the bill?
It helps lawyers.
It helps lawyers, yes. It's one place to...
Do they need help?
I really can't speak for lawyers. I can only speak for what motor vehicles do.
I think they need help.
Well, psychiatric, you know, that bill is not before us.
Wasn't it a good bill, Keith?
I think it's a good bill. The thing is that the Supreme Court has put very stringent requirements on these affidavits.
I'll say they have.
And there have been some cases that have been thrown out because of affidavits, and usually the defense of the affidavit is raised by opposing counsel after the statute of limitations run. And it's really a trap for any lawyer who is not prepared by these affidavits or had no experience.
You mean the due diligence requirement?
The Carroll case.
I'm well aware.
The meeting is adjourned.
Thanks.
You got off. 4 o'clock.
I may not be back.
You got off pretty well with that boy sitting so close to you there.
Work session.
I was wondering.
I've been working all day.
I was sorry you weren't there all the time.
I got to go to
Oh, yeah.